Hey, before we get to the show, I wanted to remind you to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders. If you haven't signed up yet, sign up now to get ad-free episodes, twice monthly bonus episodes, and a whole bunch of other cool stuff at patreon.com/curbsiders.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cash Like More Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Molly Hoyblein, joined by my co-host, Dr. Ira Krishnauskaya. On today's show, we discuss infertility with our guest, Dr. Brinda Bhavan. Ira, will you remind the audience what we do on our show?
You got it, Molly. We are the Internal Medicine Podcast. We use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. And we have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Brinda Bhavan. We're covering infertility workup, the definitions, the prevalence, how common is it, and also ways to treat it. And then we had a little bit nudge about fertility preservation and egg freezing. And just as background, Dr. Brinda Bhavan went to medical school residency, did her REI fellowship at Stanford, and she's a board-certified clinical assistant professor at Stanford in the OB-GYN REI division. She does a lot of medical education. She contributes to research as part of studies working on fertility. And also, she's a member of the Maternal and Child Health Research Institute. So we are very lucky to have Dr. Bhavan as our guest tonight.
And a reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. So without further ado, let's get to it. Yay. Well, Dr. Bhavan, thank you so much for joining us today. Are you okay if we call you Brinda?
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Amazing. Well, in this lightning round, we just like to ask some rapid fire questions of our guests to get to know you a little bit better. Could you tell us about a hobby or interest that you have outside of medicine?
Oh, yes. So I'm born in LA, but I have moved to the Bay Area since undergrad and stayed for my med training and married a San Franciscan. So I'm a Bay Area convert and I'm a big Warriors basketball fan. So it's a really exciting time for us and it was a great game last night. So I'm stoked. Yeah, fingers crossed it keeps going well.
I agree. I may or may not have been there, Brinda, and it was wild.
It was my gosh.
I was worried there was going to be a fight. My blood pressure was rising. I was like, are they going to need a medical professional? And I was like, it's okay. There's millions of them, including their sports.
Right. But you are ready and willing, which is great. Oh, that's exciting.
I kind of want to do some deep breathing exercises with Draymond, but then I was like, just let them be. It's okay.
It's so true. I resonate.
Yeah. Well, it's so nice to be on here with three Bay Area folks. And I think, you know, we in the Bay Area love a good growth mindset and kind of learning from things. And so wondering for you, Brinda, if you could share maybe a favorite failure and what you learned from that.
Yeah, gosh. I think that as I've gone through life, there, you know, are a few to choose from, but it's kind of fun on these to not choose something maybe career or education related. And so a big one for me, I think being a very type A OCD person, as a lot of fertility docs proudly are, is that I'm not really a natural athlete. There's some stuff I'm better at than others, but my foray into skiing, which I really wanted to get into up north here, closer to Tahoe, was just hilarious. And I think that I acknowledged, so I, you know, being from LA, never really grew up with snow, came here for college. They did a freshman year ski trip. My roommate was from Hawaii. I'm from LA. So we were both really ski naive and took a class. And she was a natural and a speed demon on the slopes. And I was a very cautious learner. And some of the kids were even annoyed with me that I was going pretty slowly and getting in their way. And I think I just was really nervous, like pizza and French fry didn't work for me. And and so I think I just decided that I'm glad I pushed my boundaries and tried something new. And I think I should revisit it one day. And I'd love to create it as a way to be active. But I also, and hopefully my daughter can get into it if I start her earlier and she maybe has lower center of gravity and has more fun with it. But yeah, I think that it's something that I am like, okay, it's okay that I'm not the best at this. I had fun trying. I acknowledge limitations and maybe I'll try again one day. So I think that it might be a silly example, but it's something I think about a lot and sometimes apply to every day where I'm like, it's okay not to be perfect at this right now or not fully enjoy it right now, but it doesn't close the door forever.
I think that's great. And many of us in all types of medicine are very type A. So that resonates for sure. And I grew up on the East Coast, so grew up skiing. And so it was easy as a kid. And then I tried snowboarding in college and it was horrible. I was like, I don't like falling this much. I don't want to hurt myself. It's a very different mindset as an adult, I think.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I think I probably couldn't like let go and just enjoy. Yeah, still working on that too.
Yeah. And do you have some favorite advice that you've ever received or favorite advice that you like to give to your mentees or learners that you would like to share with us?
I love that. So I remember being on my sebi as an OB-GYN interested medical student. And I think I was so eager to help that I kind of was like, you know, what can I help with? Anything I could do? And I got some really good feedback from a senior resident who was like, I'd love if you take it one step further. And as we're, you know, running the list or rounding, you just keep really active listening and a list of things that, you know, you hear come up that you think might be appropriate for a student to help with. And let's take it one step further. And when you come up to me and ask, how can I help? Maybe you could say, oh, I heard this on rounds. We need to call this consult. We need to follow up to get these records. We need to check in with this patient about her symptoms today. Maybe if you just put something more specific on the list of I'm happy to help with anything, but how about this one thing in particular, that kind of removes the kind of whole tangled web of things that seniors have to manage and, you know, give everyone a role and can help kind of ease their to-do list, you know, that you could help with. And I really took that to heart and I find that applicable to this day. So I think I try to teach that to trainees and try to implement it myself when helping colleagues. I think we're lifelong learners. So that's just something that I remember. My sister's an intern right now. I remember telling her and try to pass that on. Try to take it one step forward and be specific.
Brenda, I love that. And Molly and I are the co-hosts for Curbsiders Teach. And I feel like for Teach episodes, we always think about like making things learner-centric. And what you just described is like basically giving an opportunity for whoever the learner is to say, like, I was not only listening, but I have a plan and I kind of like followed it through. And here's what I'm suggesting kind of I can help with. Because I think sometimes we ask people like, oh, what are you working on right now? Or like, what do you want us to focus on as we're precepting or in the OR or whatever it is? But when somebody actually tells you what to focus on, it allows us as educators to be like, oh my God, zoom in. Like this person has thought about it and has almost their own SMART goal of where they want to be and what they want to do. And I can imagine for you, like taking that one step further in training, I'm sure has paid off. And it sounds like many people have heard from you about that in your career as well.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad that you guys agree. I found it to be quite helpful.
Awesome. Well, Ira, thank you for that shout out to Curbsiders Teach.
I'm gonna always, you know.
We are so excited to talk about infertility today because I feel like many people in primary care kind of struggle with women's health topics. And so always happy to bring more women's health to this platform. So we'll start with a case from Cashlack Memorial. As a quick disclaimer, our case is a cisgender couple, and we will use male and female pronouns for infertility in this discussion. But we want to recognize that non-binary or trans patients may also present with infertility. So we have Tatiana and her male partner, Victor, and they're coming to discuss their desire to conceive with their PCP. They're both 35 years old, no medical problems, not taking any medications. They've been having unprotected sex for the past year without specifically trying for pregnancy, but now they want to actively start working towards having children. Neither has ever been pregnant or contributed to someone else's pregnancy. So just to start, could you help us by defining infertility and outline how common it is?
Yeah, no, this is a great intro case. And this is perfect because we're just on the heels of National Infertility Awareness Week. And so I'm so glad with our timing, and I'm grateful to you both for raising awareness on the topic within your community of listeners. So infertility is defined in a number of ways, actually. So in 2023, the American Society of Reproductive Medicine updated the definition formally of infertility. I think traditionally we think of it as if you're considering a heterosexual couple, that the female partner, if less than 35, has been trying for 12 or more months of regular unprotected intercourse and has not achieved a successful pregnancy, that is diagnostic of infertility. If 35 and older, we say trying for 6 or more months. And the other things are any medical condition off the bat that would warrant help to get pregnant. So we don't need to falsely hold someone to this timeline. So if someone has PCOS and is not ovulating or rarely ovulating and they need help to ovulate, we can help them sooner. If someone says they've had loss of periods and appear Turners or maybe they're Turner mosaic, you know, we don't need to wait to work them up. Someone says I have horrific vaginismus or my partner has ejaculatory or erectile dysfunction, we will also say, let's help you sooner. So anything medically that warrants, you know, immediate attention, we should help with and is falling under the category of infertility. And then lastly, really importantly, is a more inclusive definition of infertility, which ASRM put out as need for donor gametes. So this can be same-sex couples. This can be single parents. And so we want to encourage that everyone, no matter their sexual orientation background or their partnership status, is allowed, you know, help with our assisted reproductive technologies to build their families. Yeah. So that's the first part of your question, is just how do we define infertility? And then, you know, what percent of the population is impacted by infertility? It's about 1 in 6 to 1 in 8 couples that we see the studies vary. So about, you know, 12 to 15% of couples will face infertility. And, you know, a lot of people are now talking about it more and more, but a lot of people are nervous to talk about it. So that might be underdiagnosed as well. But I think it's so important to share, and why, you know, I really spend a lot of time talking with my patients that they're not alone. This is really common. And so many people come to me and they just feel all their friends are getting pregnant without trying, or you hear a lot. And it's important to talk about, you know, preventing unplanned pregnancies, or, you know, I have other patients tell me that they, you know, can't get another baby shower invite or see another stroller walking down the street. Just seems everyone around them is just having no issues. And it's not true. And I'm grateful that a lot of people in the public eye have been more open talking about their struggles with infertility and miscarriage, because it is so common. And I think really individuals shouldn't feel alone. And I really hope they reach out, you know, to their primary care providers and individuals like myself, OB-GYN fertility specialists, for assistance.
Brenda, that was so helpful, and also just kind of a landscape view of both the definitions and truly how common it is, you know, anywhere from 1 in 6 and 1 in 8 couples. And for a couple like this with Tatiana and Victor, who are both 35, don't have medical problems, and they're saying, you know, we've been having sex without contraception, though we're now just starting to kind of actively try for a pregnancy, how would you talk to them about this? And would you share that you are kind of maybe putting that definition of infertility out into the conversation?
Yeah, I definitely think it's worth, you know, digging into the history a little bit more and understanding, you know, does Tatiana have regular cycles? Do they have any issues with intercourse? How often are they having intercourse? So if some people say, yeah, we're pretty regular, a few times a week, or yeah, you know, we don't really use ovulation predictor kits, but I have an idea of my ovulatory window and we've been aiming for a little bit more frequent intercourse during that time. Or if I hear couples say, you know, we kind of live apart, or, you know, we're just, it's really hard, or work is crazy, or, you know, maybe it's not very often. So that's kind of giving me a sense of like how much sperm exposure, you know, is there at the right time in a cycle. Because I have some people who will come to me and say, yeah, I've only been trying for 3 months, but we haven't used contraception for the past 10 years in our relationship, and we're active regularly enough. So it's super important to put it into that kind of finer context. So I think if Tatiana and Victor shared that they were pretty regularly sexually active, it's been a year and they haven't had any pregnancy episodes, that they would warrant some initial testing to explore what could be a potential cause. It's great to hear that they're both healthy, no concerning, you know, history on chronic conditions or medication use or issues with sexual function. But yeah, I would recommend that we explore to see if there's a, you know, found causative factor, or about of the couples with infertility, a third is unexplained. And so sometimes people come back with everything's reassuring, but they could benefit from treatment still.
I think that's a great segue into kind of discussing what that exactly looks like to start to explore it more. And I've seen really wide estimates for what percentage of the time infertility is related to male factor problems. I think I saw something from like 5 to 50%, and maybe a third is sort of what I saw as yes. typical. So I'd love to hear what statistic you cite there. But then thinking about the male partner or the sperm donating partner, what would be the initial workup for them?
Yeah, no, and it really does vary, just as you were highlighting, in that studies can show a range. And so I think that male factor is a very common cause. I will cite that it is that wider range, about a third of cases can be attributed to it. But we also know that it's not isolated male factor. It often can come in partnership with the female partner having lower counts or quality concerns, or, you know, uterine tubal factor. So it often can be multifactorial. But for focusing on the male partner for that part of the question, we'll start with a semen analysis. We like 2 to 5 days of abstinence and then providing a sample. I usually will tell people, if you're trying during your ovulatory window, maybe to aim for giving that sample before or after, so you can save that sperm for the time of trying to conceive. But also doing a really in-depth history and screening any past chronic medical issues, surgeries, medication usage, really asking pointedly about any issues with sexual function. I think some people are really nervous to share. And then also some people don't know that there are things they've done that could contribute. So I had a patient once who unfortunately was in a car accident and started taking testosterone to build muscle back and didn't know that that was inhibitory of sperm production. So only when I did the semen analysis and came back azoospermic did we see that, oh, wait, you know, what could be potential causes? And he shared about that history. And so I think a huge thing is for us to really gain the confidence and trust of our patients so they feel comfortable to disclose. But yeah, and then I think also, if I'm anticipating, you know, a likelihood of going to fertility treatments, we will do infectious disease screening. That's a kind of regulation for all providers helping people conceive, to check that beforehand for both partners. And then also for both partners, offering preconception genetic carrier screening. And that could be for a couple with a history of infertility or not, just trying to start building their family, check that they don't match for any autosomal recessive conditions. And that's optional, but something I talk about on the male side and female side, but just to answer your question.
This episode is brought to you by Grammarly. Folks, I have a lot of competing priorities in life. I am a clinician. I am an educator. I am a sometimes podcaster. And there's a lot of background work that requires a little bit of low-level thinking that does take up a lot of time with all these competing priorities. And so it's helpful to have a tool that can take care of some of that sort of lighter thinking and organize your thoughts in a way so that you can focus on the things that really matter. I am a known Luddite. I am wary of technology and wary of AI in general, but I will say AI is important. I have to recognize it's here to stay, and Grammarly offers AI in a way that both supports and kind of hones your own writing and your own ideas. You can unlock your creativity with Grammarly AI, and that's whether you're brainstorming for a next podcast episode or trying to write a compelling script. Grammarly is an ultimate partner in idea generation. You can say goodbye to writer's block because it helps you effortlessly refine your thoughts and enhance your content's clarity. And if that sounds good to you, you should know that that was written largely with the support of Grammarly AI. So it can be done. And what it does is it helps you jumpstart your writing. It doesn't do the work for you, but it gets you started and can help refine and clarify your tone. It can make your content a little bit easier to understand, and it can simplify complex information so you can deliver compelling drafts in seconds. 93% of professionals report that Grammarly helps them get more work done. So let Grammarly take the busy work off your plate so you can focus on high impact work. Download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. This episode is brought to you by Figs. Here at the Curbsiders, we are always talking about the latest medical breakthroughs. But if I'm being honest, there was one thing we weren't seeing any major advancements in, and that's medical scrubs. Back when I was on in the inpatient wards, I would literally get my scrubs out of a vending machine. They were either the consistency of tissues or of burlap. They were itchy, they were boxy, they did not fit right. And then about 5 years ago, I heard about Figs, and I remember thinking, oh wait, scrubs can actually look good. Figs are made for all of us in healthcare. They are lightweight, they are breathable, they are antimicrobial, and they have pockets. Pockets for your stethoscope, your pager, that parking ticket you forgot to validate, all of it. Watto is a big fan of figs. He now owns 5 pairs, and when he is wearing scrubs, he is only wearing figs. And we here at the Curbsiders have teamed up with figs, and now Curbsiders listeners can get 15% off. Just go to wearfigs.com and use code FIGSRX. That's FIGSRX. We're always talking about advancements in medicine. When it comes to scrubs, you can't get any more advanced than figs.
That's super helpful, Brenda. I wonder, you mentioned kind of the semen analysis, and I wonder, what are you looking for specifically, if you could give us kind of a sense of those maybe components? And then how do we use those answers to say, like, you don't think that Victor has significant erectile or ejaculatory dysfunction? You know, is that something that we can even conclude from the semen analysis?
Oh, great question. So I'll answer backwards. So sexual function doesn't necessarily correlate with our semen analysis findings. So we can find that someone has a normal semen analysis when they are able to provide a sample, but they could share that they have issues with being able to maintain an erection. They have issues with premature ejaculation. And so sometimes I really have to ask my patients that start sharing about that, you know, what percent of the time do you think you're able to deposit sperm within the vagina? And, you know, sometimes patients will say, I don't know if ever, or maybe half-half, or we're not really sure. And then I have couples that they say, you know, they're fine when they're on their own self-stimulating, but it's within trying to have intercourse and thinking about their partner and comfort and any pain or pleasure concerns, that then they kind of have, you know, some, you know, anxieties about performance. And then that can make it difficult, whether they're unable to release sperm or it prematurely occurs. And so I really try to set the stage that I know these are personal questions. I know they're a sensitive, intimate nature. It's really important for me to understand, like, how best to help you. So I think that the semen analysis and those issues don't necessarily correlate. And you could have a normal semen analysis and have problems. And you can have no problems and have a concerning semen analysis. And then sometimes you will see both. For the parameters on the semen analysis, we're really focusing on 4 main parameters. So one is volume. We'd like at least 1.5 mils of fluid. And then for concentration, we'd like at least 15 to 20 million sperm, whether moving or not, per milliliter. And then for motility, we'd like 35 to 40% moving. And then for the morphology, or under a high-powered field, how many sperm look normal, we'd like at least 4%. So a lot of people get disconcerted because they're like, oh, so most of my sperm looks abnormal. And so, yeah, it's true. They can have, you know, double head, double tail, not the right progression pattern. You know, other things that are more subtle we'll look at are viscosity, agglutination, number of round cells that might comment on immature sperm or concern for infection. So there's more subtle findings that we can look at and the lab might comment on depending where you got your semen analysis done. But those are what we're focusing on. So we're actually able to take the total volume times the concentration times the motility, and we can get our total modal count. So like in an ejaculate sample, how many million moving sperm do we have? And generally, our reproductive urologists at Stanford would say we'd ideally like 20 to 40 million moving sperm for intercourse. And if we're really under that, we're hoping for about 5 million moving sperm to be able to help with intrauterine insemination. But if we're much lower than that, like few sperm, few moving sperm, you know, then we're really thinking a couple might benefit by going directly to IVF and with help from ICSI, intracytoplasmic sperm injection. And then every now and then you'll find individuals who have no sperm. And so then we'll, you know, repeat it. We never go off one sample. We're always saying there's sperm variability. It's reflective of what was going on in your life 3 months ago. Maybe you were sick, super stressed, COVID, fever, something. So we check it again about, you know, 2 to 4 weeks later. And if it's persistently abnormal, I'll refer to a urologist and, you know, or myself, we can start the workup with some hormonal genetic testing as indicated to kind of work up the more severe abnormal parameters that we might see.
That's super helpful. And from a PCP perspective, like if you're just starting this workup, if everything's kind of in the normal range, is that sufficient, or people should be going back to look at these numbers that you're citing and kind of double check to make sure they're actually like in the high normal or something?
No, I think if, you know, you more traditionally people will use the WHO classification, but you can kind of look at your lab, what your normal parameters are. And if they're within normal range, most likely that's reassuring. I think that, you know, a lot of times the ways that primary care providers are so helpful is just more informative when we can see a patient at initial consultation and have some data to work on. We're always happy to order that data and see them back, but maybe we can do a little bit more counseling just to say, you know, overall, I don't know how much male factor is at play here given the reassuring semen analysis. Or sometimes people come to me like, is my med playing a role? Or, you know, we have to tell patients we can't know quality from this test as much as quantity. Little bit maybe we'll get a purview into it with morphology, but there's some more sensitive testing about sperm DNA fragmentation and oxidative stress. That's more of a conversation I think for the fertility doctor or male reproductive urologist to consider for recurrent pregnancy loss or kind of abnormal fertilization history or unexplained infertility. Some providers consider it. So but I think for the purposes of, you know, initially ordering it and doing a screen, trusting those parameters is okay. Yeah. One thing I will say is sometimes the volume comes back low and I just point blank ask my patients just to normalize it. It can be really kind of a new thing to collect sperm in a cup. And so I'll tell people it's okay that if you missed or it was hard or it didn't all make it in. And even this morning I had a patient who just was like, oh yeah, you know, both times I tried, I really didn't get the whole sample. And I was like, oh, I'm glad you told me. Because then we get a sense like, is it really just low volume ejaculate or really probably, and all the other counts are normal. So we feel probably it's a normal sample or is maybe some production issue at play. So I think that trusting the parameters is okay and following up anything or getting a second opinion from us that you have any concern about is just fine.
And Brenda, you mentioned like if, you know, this was something that happened, you were sick 2 months ago or something, like you would repeat the sample. And just thinking about from the PCP perspective, maybe if somebody comes back with a semen analysis that has absent or low sperm counts, would you want us to kind of repeat that sample before, you know, referring to you or other or urology, or are there other testing, kind of next step testing that we should be thinking about if there's some azoospermia or oligospermia?
Yeah, I mean, that would be above and beyond. So no pressure. I think that if you got a really concerning sample, just ordering a repeat 2 to 4 weeks later for another data point is great. I mean, traditionally, you would say, okay, to get a whole new batch of sperm takes 3 months, but that is a bit of a time delay for patients. So I think you'll see different fertility providers might repeat it 2 to 4 weeks later. So that's a very great starting place. And just even to put in a referral to a fertility doctor or put in a referral to your reproductive urologist in your group. So that's a nice step one. There is, you know, really, I think not expected, but would be icing on the cake is our practice committee guidelines will say if we have less than 10 million moving sperm, then we can start with some hormonal testing and FSH, LH, estradiol, testosterone, check a TSH prolactin, if this is all in the setting of infertility. And then if it's less than 5 million moving sperm, you can add on some genetic testing, which is karyotype, Y chromosome microdeletion. And then if someone's azoospermic and you're kind of worried about congenital bilateral absence of the vas deferens, then you might be, you know, just checking were they ever, you know, tested to be a CF carrier, but really more like, do they maybe have a mild undiagnosed CF or something that would be rare? Most times people would be coming to you with that history. So we would really expect for once you're seeing the subspecialist. So if you had done that, that would just be incredible. So we'd be like, shout out to this podcast for setting people up for success.
Amazing. Well, anything else that you think we should touch on for male infertility, or should we move on to female?
Yeah, I think there's always so many exciting things on the horizon to talk about. We can move over to the female side.
Okay. If there's some really exciting, you know, tidbit you want to share, happy to hear it as well.
I think just thinking about, we're so lucky, both where you guys are at UCSF and Stanford and in the community, there are great male reproductive urologists. And so just, you know, leaning on them and, you know, there's great things like mental ask, should I take supplements? And there was all these studies about like zinc and magnesium, and our reproductive urologist, shout out to Dr. Eisenberg, who's amazing and does so much to support us. You know, maybe just supports a daily multivitamin. And then sometimes you can consider coenzyme Q10 for a boost as an antioxidant. And so there's a lot of like lifestyle, you know, avoiding tobacco, drugs, marijuana, excessive alcohol intake, avoiding heat exposures to the pelvis. So, you know, some people get their sauna in their backyard or spa area, or, you know, they're doing the jacuzzi too frequently, you hear. But I think I get a lot of people who are stressed, like, oh, we were on vacation 3 weeks ago and my partner went in the jacuzzi, and that's okay, you know, once or twice, just not regular everyday habits. Yeah, so I think there's lifestyle to consider. We talked about supplements, other things. Yeah, I mean, if there's azoospermia, we'll really lean on our, or any abnormal findings, really leaning on the urologist. They'll do a physical exam. They'll check for any, like, abnormalities like a varicocele. They will talk about need for testing, ultrasound, talk about options like testicular extraction of sperm. So those are all kind of other areas within male factor. Yeah, I was just asking about Ozempic use in male factor. You know, is it safe? Do you tell male patients to stop? But there's some data that might improve sperm parameters, but we don't have long-term, you know, safety data. So those are kind of the things we're exploring in this new world we have today. Yeah, so a long answer to your question, but just throwing out some last tidbits on male factor.
Thank you for bringing back the lifestyle stuff, because I think that is really important and we didn't touch on it earlier. And do you counsel people to stop the Ozempic or just continue it for now?
So good question. I was just asking Dr. Eisenberg about this, and I think right now they're not telling people for male patients to stop. As they've seen, you know, it's kind of like a catch-22, right? Because obesity is not good for, you know, gamete health either. And maybe it's going to help control other medical issues. And so I think we need more safety data moving forward. Right now, we're not having patients necessarily stop. Some of the sperm parameters have looked like they've improved for people who've had issues and use the medicine on GLP-1 agonists. But I think, you know, we just have to proceed cautiously and tell couples, like, we don't have the full picture with research yet. For my female patients, we do advise a 1 to 2 month washout period before we move into pregnancy attempts for GLP-1 agonists when, you know, purposely trying to move forward to build a family. There are, you know, some individuals who've been using Ozempic. It's helped them lose weight. They really weren't having regular cycles before. Now they're cycling a more regularly, and then they found themselves pregnant. And so then, you know, it's a conversation to stop the medicine and watch the pregnancy moving forward. But when intentionally trying to get pregnant, we're advising to stop the medicine. Here at Stanford, we say 2 months beforehand.
Great. And sorry, I should have mentioned this earlier, but we should try to avoid brand names. So,
forgive me. Yeah. So I was just sorry that patient was on that one, but this is just in the category of GLP-1 agonists. Yeah.
That's super helpful, Brenda, because I feel like we don't often have that counseling conversation. We're just so happy that people are on, you know, semaglutide or a GLP that's working for them. And we're like, wow, you've lost the weight. And that's so great. And so it's helpful to, you know, hear your counseling around that kind of. And we'll probably get more into this as we talk about things to avoid and medications and, you know, same kind of lifestyle things. But if we focused on Tatiana specifically and kind of took a step back to think about a framework for infertility causes as related to the female partner, how do you think about that?
Yeah, I use an anatomical approach. So I kind of work my way through the female reproductive tract. So I'm thinking vagina, any issues with vaginismus, any septum, any agenesis concerns, you know, that would more the latter two present with like amenorrhea issues. And then cervix, any cervical stenosis from cervical procedures, for instance. Uterine factor would be fibroids, polyps, Asherman or adhesive scar tissue disease, or some uterine anomaly like a septum or bicornuate or unicornuate uterus that can have related both maternal neonatal risks, or I should say maternal fetal or perinatal risks. And then the tubes need to be patent so that sperm and egg can meet. So considering, you know, that there's no history of intense, like ruptured appy, for instance, and maybe someone has really bad adhesive disease or untreated sexually transmitted infections that can cause bilateral blockage. So we'll do, you know, very careful past medical, past surgical, you know, screenings, and then the ovaries. So thinking about, is an egg getting released, and is it regularly releasing? What's the quality of that egg? The biggest contributor is age, maternal age, but also things like smoking history or cocaine use or obesity or endometriosis that can also affect not just, you know, pain with intercourse and inflammatory environment within the uterus pelvis can cause tubal blockage and distortion, but also can impact egg quality and subsequent embryo formation. So, yeah, so that's how I kind of organize it in my mind. And of course, you know, looking at the overall picture of pre-pregnancy health, right? Do you have poorly controlled medical issues? You know, we want to make sure that we're not anemic. We have a healthy thyroid and no diabetes concerns, and just trying to really optimize with healthy lifestyle measures before getting pregnant.
That was a really nice from the inside out structural.
Yes, I got it. I got a visual for patients. Or when I teach, I'm like, okay, just think step by step through the anatomy.
Where you need to get to. And
yes.
Thinking about ovulatory dysfunction or ovarian dysfunction, if Tatiana has regular menses every 26 days, what kind of first step would you recommend for hormonal or lab testing for her?
Yeah. So normal cycles are about, you know, 21 to 35 days apart. And so she's falling within that. And for ovarian reserve, I'll start with an anti-Müllerian hormone level. So this is a glycoprotein that's released by the preantral follicles that make up our egg pool, for instance. And so this is emitted into the bloodstream so we can do a serum draw and detect this. And so the higher our AMH level, the larger our egg pool is thought to be. Every lab varies with its assay what's normal. And yeah, so this is not meant to be like very, very, very specific because it's an ELISA-based platform. So there's a lot of inter and intra-assay variability. So if you checked, you know, my AMH level here at Stanford versus UCSF, you know, we might see a little bit of variation just because the platforms might be slightly different. You take the same sample, run it a couple times, there's going to be a little variation. So we're not really, I have some patients say, I went from 3 to 2.5. You know, I don't see that really as a significant decline. I think of it as stable. So really looking at big buckets. Is it like below the normal parameters? So it's low. Is it within normal or is it very high? That's how I think about it. And so that's one test. Another for blood tests is to do a cycle day 3. There's a little flexibility, cycle day 2 to 4 at 3, FSH estradiol. And so follicle stimulating hormone, as you know, people might know, is, you know, talking to our ovaries to encourage an egg to grow for the month. And then when that egg starts growing and makes estrogen, that feeds back on the FSH and we'll kind of say, we're good, we have an egg growing. That's like a very simplistic view of it. So we want to look in the early stage before an egg is growing. So we want to confirm it's in a low estrogen setting. How hard is FSH having to kind of work and push out to get an egg to grow for the month? So we'd like to see it less than 10 milliUs per mil, but, you know, that fairly varies. And so we kind of like AMH because it can be checked anytime in the cycle. FSH is just another, with estrogen, another layer of detail that might speak to like, how hard are we having to work to ovulate? And are people kind of coming well above 10? Maybe body's having to work a little bit harder, suggesting some ovarian aging. Or if someone's like, you know, well above 30, maybe there's some concern for, you know, a peri or menopausal status if periods have become irregular or stopped.
Brenda, I was just wondering how you would change these tests relative to if Tatiana had told you like, actually my cycle is like 20 to 22 days. So kind of like shorter cycle, but please keep going with the test.
No, I love that. Oh, just the last one I was going to say in rounding out the blood test is an antral follicle count. So this is a transvaginal ultrasound. It's like easiest to see the ovaries. You can do it abdominally, just a little trickier and depending on the body habitus, and it can just be not as accurate. And so we prefer a transvaginal ultrasound to do an AFC or antral follicle count. I tell my patients, like layperson speak, ovaries look like chocolate chip cookies and we're counting the chocolate chips. And, you know, from our pool every cycle, but really it's a continuous process. But for ease of thinking about it, I think every cycle, a new wave of chocolate chips is coming up. So thousands of eggs eggs microscopically were considered, then hundreds, then we get this like final candidate cohort. And so we see about 5 to 10 per side, and then average age reproductive individual would be normal. And so we think if that cohort is normal, then the group they're coming from is about normal in size. If the cohort is low, the pool is small. If the cohort is high, the pool might be big. And so that tends to correlate. And that's also how we diagnose polycystic appearing ovaries. If you have more than 20 chocolate chips per side on our newer ultrasound machines, or if either it's either ovary, and if either ovary in volume is greater than 10 cubic centimeters. So those are some of the things we're just like gathering from the ultrasound additional, looking at the uterus and 2D or 3D examinations to see, is it normal in appearance, any concerns, polyps, fibroids, scar, septum, things like that. Yeah. So I think that if someone has regular cycles, that's what I'll start with. If people have shorter cycles, you're to your question, then I'll say, okay, let's maybe check a thyroid function. That tends to be more like, can be on the shorter side. If people have longer cycles, we're thinking thyroid, prolactin for prolactinoma. And then you're also wanting to get, do we have Rotterdam criteria for PCOS? So that's meeting 2 out of 3 of irregular cycles, clinical or lab evidence of hyperandrogenism or polycystic appearing ovaries. But that really, a lot of people are kind of like, my cycles are kind of irregular. I had some acne in high school. And so you have some soft calls and some like slam dunks, where people are like, I have really severe acne and really hirsute, and I get 3 periods a year, and you scan them and they have an, you know, AMH of 10 and 30 follicles on each side. You're like, okay, that's a slam dunk, probably PCOS. But other things you also don't want to miss out are adrenal abnormalities. So individuals that might have non-classic CAH, so you can check a 17-OHP level. Individuals that might have an adrenal tumor, so you can check a DHEAS level. You know, just for looking at maybe in the PCOS picture of lab hyperandrogenism, you know, free and total testosterone levels. So some people might add that. So a little bit more to do if the cycles are farther apart. You know, people get older and have lower counts, they can also start to have shorter cycles, and they start getting something called loop effects, luteal out of phase recruitment of a follicle. So like, instead of recruiting a follicle at the beginning of the follicular phase, you know, once you're menstruating, you'll even start having it happen in the late luteal phase. And so then you're like, I was taking care of someone earlier today, actually, who is just having like a 15-day cycle. We're like, how is this possible? You know, and so she's probably starting to grow the egg even before she's bled from the former ovulation. And so they're kind of like overlapping and short cycles. And that tends to happen when people have very severe diminished ovarian reserve.
This episode is brought to you by Panacea Financial. 14 years of school, countless hours of training, and finally, you're about to finish. That's where Dr. Cynthia, a soon-to-be attending physician, found herself. She had worked hard, saved what she could, and planned a much-needed break before starting her first job. But then the unexpected came. Cobra insurance and relocation costs, expenses were piling up fast. That's when a friend told her about Panacea Financial. She applied for a PRN personal loan, and within 48 hours, the funds were in her account. No hoops to jump through, no waiting games, just personalized, doctor-specific support from a banker who truly understood her situation. The loan didn't just cover her expenses, it gave her something even more valuable, peace of mind. Whether you're wrapping up training, planning a move, or facing the financial unknown, Panacea Financial is here to help, because doctors deserve better. Learn more at PanaceaFinancial.com. Banking built for doctors by doctors. Panacea Financial, Division of Primis Bank, member FDIC.
So when we say the third day of the cycle, we're saying they start bleeding, and then 3 days later, or 2 to 4 if it happens to fall on the weekend.
Great question. My patients ask me all the time. So first day of full flow bleeding is considered cycle day one. So if people spot for a couple days, but they get like the first day, they usually need to use a pad or tampon, they have bright red bleeding, that counts as day one. And so yeah, day three is what we typically will classically call it, but you have a little bit of flex if it's tricky with scheduling.
Perfect. And then you're looking at the AMH, and if it's low, you're worrying that they have a low egg pool. So thinking about premature ovarian failure or early menopause or perimenopause, if it's normal.
That would be super low. Sorry to interrupt. Okay. That would be, and then we really want to correlate it with what's the interval count, what are your cycles looking like? Because still menopause is a clinical diagnosis, but, you know, 12 months, no periods. But correct. If it's just borderline low, it's well, that's an important that yeah, that's the important thing I tell my patients. You know, I had a good friend who just checked hers and it normal here is 1 to 4 and she came back at 0.6 and she was really stressed. You know, am I going to have infertility? And like, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just am so excited to share this one study. There's this beautiful time to conceive study that was done out of North Carolina and they looked at hundreds of couples who no history of infertility, just starting to get pregnant, 0 to 3 months. And they checked the AMH on all these individuals. They were heterosexual couples. So they checked the female partners. And incidentally, a number were noted to have an AMH less than 1. So they kind of called that low, and above 1 they called normal. And they prospectively followed them out, age stratified, and said, do the people in the same age categories who have a lower AMH have a harder time getting pregnant or more infertility, more miscarriage? Is this speaking to like difficulty getting pregnant or quality issues with the pregnancies? And they saw no difference. That so I really tell people that makes sense in my head, because whether you have a small pool or a big pool, you're still releasing 1 egg a month on average or per cycle. And so it kind of equates the playing field. But where it makes things different is when I try to stimulate for eggs freezing cycle or IVF cycle, I can only work with what I have. My meds won't make more grow. So I can only work, you know, if someone's coming to me with a small pool, we might not get as many eggs as someone who comes to me with a larger pool using the same proactive approach to optimize, you know, stimulation dosing. So AMH is not always predictive of ability to get pregnant. But yes, if in someone who has a history with of infertility, low counts, and maybe that correlates with age or not, you know, you're just thinking, is the pool smaller? But it's not always a pathologic finding. Yeah. But I will, Molly, so sorry, let you get back to your nice summary.
Thank you. No, that's super helpful, because I do, yeah, I think people, patients get nervous when they see it's on the low side and they say, oh, does that mean I'm about to go through menopause? And yes, it's very reassuring to be able to tell them it doesn't have a big impact if it's sort of on that low normal side.
Yeah, no, menopause prediction is so hard. There's some studies that has to be like exceptionally low. And maybe then within the next few years, you could go through menopause. And, you know, average age of menopause is 51 in North America. And we don't call it like primary ovarian insufficiency or premature ovarian failure in the older terminology until if it's unless it's before 40. So between 40 and 51 can be just like normal variation. And so some people ask, well, why is my pool small? And you could have been born that way. Probably genetics. You're born with a smaller pool or you go through that pool faster. Smoking history or, you know, there are some things that can contribute to the decline, but mostly it's just unique to someone's, you know, person and their genetics.
Yeah. And Brenda, I was just thinking that to round up Molly's amazing summary around the antral follicle counts, you were talking about like 5 to 10 per side. But I guess, you know, as we think about PCPs or people in the front lines, how much of this workup would you want, you know, PCPs to kind of come in knowing and ordering, and versus, you know, maybe what you would do specifically on your side, you know, kind of seeing them as an infertility expert?
Oh my gosh, love this question. So I'll like tag team it with you and Molly for the nice summary you started. So I think if normal cycle lengths and AMH, cycle day 3, FSH, estradiol are great. A lot of people kindly order an ultrasound through the radiology department, but they don't always comment on the antral follicle count. They might comment if the ovaries look polycystic and they'll make that comment. But then I end up having to repeat the ultrasound myself anyways, because I want to assess the antral follicle count myself. And that's something that some OB-GYNs know how to do, definitely, but you know, all REIs will know how to do. And so that part I think you can save for us. And then if someone has irregular cycles, no one will ever fault you and probably be grateful for getting a TSH if they're longer, adding that prolactin. I think that's a great starting place. For some of the more subtle adrenal testing I referenced, you know, that you could hold off for us. Okay. You know, if someone's coming to you with severe hyperandrogenism, then of course, you know, you guys are so skilled on, you know, that workup as well. And we trust you and would love any workup there, but it's not expected. So I think just to recap, like Tatiana and Victor, if someone came to me with an AMH, cycle day 3, FSH, estradiol, and a semen analysis, excellent. There is an additional study that you can order with your radiology group called an HSG, hysterosalpingogram, that will be that contrast dye study that does x-rays to look at the uterus in 3D with contrast and follow out the tubes to make sure they're filling and spilling. So that's huge too, because if you guys order that for us, and the radiology team will help them to prep for that, because that's usually on cycle day 6 to 10, and it's good to pre-medicate with ibuprofen and or Tylenol because it can be crampy, painful. I like to warn patients. But then you're coming to me and I'll know, you know, what's your cycles? What are your ovarian reserve counts? Do we have normal sperm? And is the uterus, you know, no major issues, and are the tubes open? So then I can really see from the major contributors each partner's giving, is there an issue area or is this most likely unexplained?
Can I just say, Brenda, I'm so happy you mentioned the pre-medicating for the HSG, because as somebody who has been both the PCP and a friend for people who have gotten these, I was told that it's like you feel like you have peritonitis essentially, and that it was like the most painful thing that they've ever experienced. So love the pre-medication idea. And I don't know if you have other kind of tips and tricks for PCPs when we counsel people, like, oh, I'm ordering this to make sure the tubes are, you know, filling and spilling, to use your terminology.
Love it.
And I'm also going to give you like 800 milligrams of ibuprofen. Is there anything else that you would say, you know, and just so you know, this might be really hard or something like that. I don't know how you counsel
on
that.
I mean, that is amazing. So I think just one to warn people. The worst is when they're not warned and they just think, oh, this is an x-ray. And
yeah.
You're like, oh, no. So I tell my patients, you'll come into a room, you'll lay flat on your back, you'll butterfly like open your legs, and there will be a speculum exam. And they'll visualize the cervix, clean it off with betadine, and put a small catheter within the cervix that they could push the contrast dye. And when that contrast dye goes in, it just is like the uterus doesn't love anything suddenly going in it. And so it'll try to cramp it out. And everyone's pain tolerance is different. So some people are like, that wasn't so bad, mild cramps. Other people say, horrific pain, I felt like fainting. And so there's a lot of sad stuff that our patients are going to find on like social media or Facebook groups, and they come in with a lot of fear. So as the providers, if we're able to just be like, heads up, this could be quite uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And I want to equip you before you go in, one, to just know it's a risk, but two, to pre-medicate. You can kind of understand people are like, pain's really, I'm nervous, or pain's okay for me. You could do ibuprofen alone, or do ibuprofen 600 to 800 or with Tylenol 1 gram 30 minutes before hand, and then take a heat pack with you. That could help too for some of that spasm pain. Those are some of the small basic things I do just to warn patients. And then I tell them it really should be the worst during the study, but after the study there can be some remnant cramping, and so they can just kind of take it easy the rest of the day as able. And if someone's been pregnant before and their gestated uterus has been stretched, the study tends to not be as painful because it's known as stretch before. If someone's never been pregnant before, it might be a little bit more uncomfortable. But even my people with secondary infertility or going for a repeat study after they've had a baby, you know, pain is just so variable, as I said. So, you know, some people are like, no problem the second time. Others are like, oh, it kind of was not fun again.
Yeah.
Because one patient told me, oh, my doctor told me it would be like a pap smear. And I was like, oh, that's not fair. It's worse.
That's what
I'm learning so much, because I refer a lot of people to REI, and we have a list of things we're supposed to order before we send, and one of them is the hysterosalpingogram, and I had no idea it was painful. So
good.
I feel terrible for all my patients who have gone through it.
But now you know, moving forward.
But yeah. Exactly. Now we know. I think that's the most important. And just hearing you like share your expert advice, Brenda, I think helps us a lot, because we need the words to be able to say as PCPs, like, here's what to expect and here's how I'm going to help you through this or help you kind of prepare for it.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that your REI group has helped you, Molly, like with a template. So that's a great idea.
Like when we put in the referral, there's like, please order, you know, the STI screening, LHFSH on day 3, the hysterosalpingogram.
Love it.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
We're all about, you know, order sets and efficiency here.
I love it.
We were happy to see them, but we wanted to be as efficient as possible.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Just one final question that's short about the testing. Does it matter when a woman gets the antral follicle count, or that could be, does that have to be specifically timed?
AMH can be any time. FSH, estradiol, ideally day 3 needed. And then for the antral follicle count, you'll get different camps of thought on this. So one is just access, right? So if someone's in the clinic with me and I want to scan them right then and there, no matter where they are in their cycle, then let's just do it. The idea is that if there's like a large dominant follicle, it might be obstructing our view of seeing all of the antral follicles, but I'll still try. try. And, you know, if I see outside of a dominant follicle growing or a large corpus luteum or something that, you know, I see a good number of follicles outside of that, then I'm reassured, like your counts are reassuring. If it's really low, then I might bring them back and aim for a cycle day 2 to 5 scan early before we're, you know, expecting dominant follicle activity. So yeah, like for instance, I had one patient who had an IUD, and we know with IUDs, it just can be a little more common to have cystic activity. So one cycle I scanned her, and one ovary had 10 antral follicles and the other had a really large simple cyst, and I couldn't see anything else. So I brought her back the next month and her ovary switched sides. So the ovary that had looked good had a new simple cyst and the other side had 10. And I was like, okay, between my two serial studies for you, you're good. So it can vary, but I think it's a conversation. I think you'll sample a number of REIs and some will be more traditional. I check it day 2 to 5 and then some will say just whenever they're there and available, bring them in.
Yeah. And Brenda, if we were to go back to Tatiana and Victor, and let's say they, you know, are, there's not a obvious cause that is being found for them, and you're, you know, about to maybe discuss unexplained infertility, can you share with us and our audience, you know, how common is this? How do you discuss it? And then specifically, maybe like what you do next in terms of like addressing or helping them with this unexplained infertility piece?
Thank you so much. Very important question. So for our couples that are diagnosed with infertility, generally, you know, that 12 to 15% of the population, we think about a third will come away with this diagnosis of unexplained infertility after doing the testing we talked about and everything comes back reassuring. So what I tell my patients is that it's kind of a double-edged sword, right? Because you're happy there's no issue, or maybe there's something just subclinical we don't have the test for yet, we can't identify, but nothing is glaringly wrong. But I know it could be frustrating as well. And I just acknowledge that emotion because a lot of people are hoping there's like one thing that they can maybe fix and then overcome it and get pregnant soon.
Yeah.
And so I've had a range of emotions of some people being like, what does that mean? And others being like, okay, I'm glad nothing is, you know, really worrisome to you. So I just, one, acknowledge that it's common and it's okay to feel a spectrum of ways about getting the diagnosis. But what I tell my patients is, while we might not know a direct cause, we can definitely help with treatments. And so the first line treatment is supraovulation IUI. So we'll take letrozole or Clomid and pair it with an intrauterine insemination. So we'll usually bring patients for a baseline ultrasound at the start of their cycle, start them on 5 days of letrozole or Clomid, which respectively are aromatase inhibitor and a selective estrogen receptor modulator. And they kind of alter the way our body sees FSH and estrogen and encourages a good quality or sometimes more than one egg to grow. And then we'll follow people for a few scans to check how is egg growing, how is lining looking. We can pair it with a one-time HCG trigger shot to really time ovulation. And then 1 to 2 days later, depending on someone's ovulation predictor kit they're checking at home, are they ovulating naturally or is it just induced by our meds? Then we will have a partner come give sperm or use the sperm source if it's donor sperm and, you know, kind of process that sperm, concentrate good quality sperm and place a speculum, visualize the cervix and deposit all the sperm at the top of the uterus on the day of ovulation. And if couples are able to, they can have more intercourse, a day or two beforehand and afterwards that evening, not required, but okay, for more sperm exposure. So that's like a quick and dirty on what an IUI cycle looks like. And we'll usually try, every practice is a little bit different, 3 to 6 IUI cycles, and then we'll regroup. And if not pregnant, we'll consider pivoting to IVF. And IVF, some people actually want to start off the bat with, because let's say, you know, Tatiana's 35, you told me, and let's say I ask her, well, how many children would you ideally like to have? And she tells me 3. So then I'm like, well, okay, let's say you got pregnant with an IUI and you come back in 2 to 3 years for your second baby. You might be 37, 38, but then the last baby might fall in your 40s. And we know that our quantity and quality of eggs will decline with advancing maternal age and particularly has a steeper, you know, rate of decline after 37, 38. And so it could be really hard for fertility treatments to be as effective now as they in the future if she were to come back later. So some of my patients who are planning, their family building will say, well, I'm kind of motivated to do IVF and do one or more cycles now to bank embryos for the future children that I want. And then it's kind of, I tell my patients, you're playing the long game here. And so you put in the work now to make embryos that nothing's a guarantee for the future, but hopefully stand a good chance to provide children now and in the future. So the idea is you do IVF as many cycles needed to get into a good place for the number of children you want. And then you can start transferring and then you'd have some embryos saved for the future. So that's why some people might go straight to IVF. But if someone has, you know, that's in the unexplained territory, you know, that was your question. But if someone obviously has blocked tubes or somebody has very low sperm counts, you know, then we might be forced to go to IVF directly.
Wow, Brenda, you just like walked us through that amazing kind of treatment option. I wonder, I think a lot of our listeners may or may not be as concrete as I am sometimes and wonder about like percentages, like percentage of chance of having a live birth. Do you have a sense of numbers that you quote to people who come in specifically for this kind of entity around unexplained infertility and kind of the options you just laid out?
Yeah, no, it's so helpful because I think a lot of people really don't know that when you first start out trying to get pregnant, like peak fertility, maybe mid to late 20s is not 100% per month. It is probably 25%, you know, and then as we're getting into early 30s, 20%, mid 30s, 15% per month, you know, as we're getting above, you know, to late 30s, early 40s, you know, you'll see some data 5 to 10% per chance per month. And so just, you know, acknowledging where people are starting out from. And then after the 6 to 12 months of trying, you know, it's so personalized. So it's hard to give these ballparks. So, you know, forgive me because you'll probably sample different people and get slightly different ranges here. But generally what I'll tell people is once you're meeting that criteria of infertility, probably your per month chance is about 3 to 5%. And we're thinking our fertility treatments could help relative to that. And so it really depends on age for IUI success, but you'll see the success rates vary from like 8 to 15% per cycle. But the repeat cycles you do at the beginning, you'll see a cumulative benefit. But as you get closer to 6 cycles and past 6 cycles, definitely you'll see this plateau. So that's why we think after 3 to 4, you could consider pivoting to IVF if ready, or some people aren't ready or want to try more naturally relative to IVF, or depending on your particular situation or insurance benefits or plan, you might, you know, flex on these options. But so that's my general range for IUI. And then for IVF also is really age dependent. And so you'll see like all comers, maybe like a 30% chance per cycle. But again, you know, if you have higher or lower counts, that'll change. And I have some patients who are dealing with such low counts, I don't think no matter how many meds I give them, I'll get a lot of eggs to grow with IVF. So maybe IVF starts to equivocate or approximate IUI success rates. And then you're thinking, what are you putting your body through? How much money is it costing when you make these decisions on treatment? But those are some of those more ballpark percentage, you know, ranges that I'll counsel people with.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned the cost because I think that is a significant barrier for a lot of people. And I found an American Family Physician article that we'll link to that estimated about 70% of women who undergo IVF go into debt, and the average cost is about $20,000. Is there anything that you could see that PCPs can help patients with kind of as they navigate this whole process, or anything that you would like to call on the bigger powers that be to help improve fertility access?
This has been one of the hardest things for me in doing what I do. I love what I do, but it kills me how much I have to think about cost and insurance. I mean, we should all be mindful providers and be trying to do cost-effective care. But when I was an OB-GYN resident, you're pregnant, you get Medi-Cal, I could take care of you. It just was like nice that way. And this is really hard that people are having to decide what's available to them with very limited resources sometimes. So, you know, in this area, we help, you know, Google, Facebook, Apple, tech companies that have great benefits, whether it's 3 full cycles covered or 100,000 lifetime. And then you'll see some people that have nothing and are completely self-pay. And the variation is just crazy. So definitely, you know, from the PCP level, I think coding is really important. I know this sounds like nitty gritty, but, you know, even when I bill, if something's infectious disease testing, I put it as infectious disease testing. Or someone has PCOS or someone has fibroids, or so I try to use a medical diagnosis, even though infertility is a medical diagnosis or disease process. But some insurances will just see this stamp of fertility testing or infertility and be like, we don't cover that. So whatever I can try to get, particularly if PCPs are helping with the workup, that could either whether it just goes through a PCP and gets covered no matter your diagnosis code, or when you're being, if the diagnosis code matters at that stage even, then just being really mindful, like if they have, you know, pain concerns, could you like put clinically suspected endometriosis or something that isn't infertility that might get them some coverage for that workup piece, even if we might not have that same option for treatment. So that's just one like small level tip. And then if I have a couple where the patient is at Stanford, but the partner is at Kaiser, and Kaiser is, you know, very inclusive and wanting to maintain as much care as they can there, I'll send them a list of here's what I need you to get, and try to get that with your primary care doctor over at Kaiser so that they won't be charged out of pocket or self-pay if they're coming to Stanford. So I try to be mindful about that. I think on a systems level, so we had, legislation recently passed that California is going to become a mandated state, meaning that we're going to mandate infertility treatment coverage for patients. But I know that
it's great.
I'm not the expert on this. I'm very happy. I think it's great because that's great for California. But I do think that there's going to be a lot of variability in implementation. So there's things you could do, right, at a state level, at an institutional level, just to be more mindful. But I mean, I've heard every story. I'm not surprised to hear you while I quote that statistic, because I've heard people who have like left jobs that they love but had no fertility benefits to work for like a large employer, like Starbucks or someone that's like giving routine fertility benefits just because it is such a large cost. Yeah. So IVF cycles can, you know, vary 25 to 30,000. And if people need to try more than once, it's hefty.
Yeah. Well, thank you for covering all that. And are there any other things that you think a PCP can, you know, should know or should be aware of to support patients through this journey and help support you as an REI specialist?
Yeah, I really appreciate what a thoughtful question this is. I think a huge thing that primary care providers can help with is just asking and screening patients. A lot of people think they will maybe only talk to their OB-GYN about this or are nervous to bring it up. And sometimes when it's even on a screening intake questionnaire, like, are you having any problems with infertility? Do you have any plans to have children in the future? I think even family planning is a huge thing about if some people are kind of, you know, not aware. I think now there's so much more discourse about egg and embryo freezing and fertility preservation. But if people aren't even really aware about that, that maybe as they're, you know, advancing maternal age and maybe not really ready to start a family as a single person with, you know, donor gametes, that maybe they're waiting for a partner or a finance situation or career education, and just to have it on the radar, it might be good to talk to someone just to learn about fertility preservation options. That's something that's huge too. So I think just normalizing it, like, this is really common, we like to do a screen for this, are you interested in learning more, could be huge. Doing the workup, as we talked about today, so we can kind of hit the ground running when they come to see us, is great.
And Brenda, just to clarify really quick, if there was somebody coming asking about the kind of like fertility preservation that you were just mentioning, do you have a age by which you kind of encourage that screen or that conversation? And also you had mentioned like getting some of the testing that we talked about, but I do wonder, like, those, that was for a specific kind of infertility definition. Is there, separate from the age kind of conversation, are there specific tests that you get in people who are not in the infertility definition treatment area?
Great question. There is no set age cutoff, really. I really look at the big picture, which is, how many children would you like to have? What's your timeline? And what's the situation in which you'd like to have those children? And, you know, do you feel very strongly about having genetically related children? Because some people might say, I'm waiting to meet someone, and if I do or if I don't, if it's harder for me to get pregnant naturally, I'm very open to adoption or blended families or not having children. Other people say, this is really important to me. I want three children. It's not going to happen for 5 years. So when people start to get into their like early to mid 30s, I think it's a, you know, good time. But I have had people, you know, who are residents or medical students and are planning a surgical career. And they're just like, I'm sure it's not going to happen, or I don't want it to happen for 10 years or something like that. So I think it's not a great finite answer, but I think we have to just look at like social history picture, timeline, desired number of children, and situation in which they'd like to start that family, how strongly they feel about having genetically related children. So, but I do think if, you know, you have a patient, they're maybe in their early mid 30s and there's not been any natural sharing about family building, you can kind of talk to them about that conversation. Sometimes I'll have like a 26-year-old come to me because they work at Google and have great benefits and be like, I want to freeze my eggs. And I definitely want to respect reproductive autonomy. And I think there's some aspect of they're like, if I leave this job, I might not have this chance again. And that's that sad but realistic cost angle we were talking about earlier. But I also want to tell them, I mean, socio-epidemiologically speaking, we can't predict every single person's, you know, time that they'll have that faster decline, but that's years away for a 26-year-old. So you can have some time to live your life, try to meet a partner, figure out what, you know, situation you'd like to build your family in. So I think that might be a little premature. So that's essentially how I kind of approach it. And then, yes, to answer the second part of your question, which is, you know, if someone is like 37, not partnered, would like two children, is like, yeah, thanks for bringing that up, I'm really interested in egg freezing, then some initial testing would be that AMH and not everyone gets it, but that cycle day 3 FSH estradiol and infectious disease, which we do hepatitis B, C, syphilis, HIV, gonorrhea, chlamydia. So you can get those. And we're very happy to continue, you know, and tag team that workup, but that would be great. If someone's like, I want to freeze embryos because I'm partnered, I'm sure I'm ready to put sperm and egg together, then I would say, let's check the sperm counts on the partner, as get a semen analysis on the partner as well, infectious disease testing for the partner. And if I don't expect every clinic to offer it, but if you have access to the preconception genetic carrier screening, you can offer that to couples as well.
Wow. My brain is exploding with so much goodness and information. Thank you so much, Brenda. That was amazing. We try to kind of, I mean, I think some of those were even amazing take home points because you kind of reminded us, you brought us back to the testing that you wanted us to get. But do you have any other specific take home points for our listeners about this topic?
Yeah, I mean, just to recap some of the things I shared before, is I just really appreciate you guys are highlighting this topic on your podcast. And the most important thing to me is for patients to feel comfortable to share, to know they're not alone, and to know that there are ways to help and support them. So a big coincidence with infertility is anxiety and depression and just mental health and stress. And so also venturing into screening in those areas and finding counseling support too for patients. We have reproductive health focused counselors in our clinic, but sometimes even getting people plugged in earlier can be really helpful. So yeah, I just really appreciate the awareness and the mindfulness and considering cost and tips and tricks to give patients when you're ordering the different parts of the workup. So yeah, I was really excited to talk on this topic. So thanks for putting up with my long answers, but I was really, really excited to share.
No, thank you so much. This has been great. Is there anything else that you'd like to plug? Anything that you are recently published or that you're working on or that you want to share as a resource for our listeners?
Yeah, thank you so much. I think my area of research is cost effectiveness, just because ART or assisted reproductive technologies is a newer field. So our first IVF baby was in the 1980s and then first ICSI case early 1990s. So a lot of this was just like, is it possible? Is it safe? Can we do it? And now we're taking a step back and being like, does everyone have access to it? And what are the costs of treatment? So some of my, you know, recent publications and submissions to conferences have to do with cost effectiveness of using gestational carriers for people that qualify, or helping lesbian couples figure out the number of donor sperm vials they should get before starting in on therapeutic donor inseminations to build their families. So that's just some of the cool stuff we're working on.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. This has been wonderful. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks again for having me. Thank you both.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole. Thank you, Ira. Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon and get all the episodes ad-free plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find the show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get your weekly show notes in your inbox, including our Curbsiders Digest, recapping the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine. And I've been Dr. Molly Hoytblein.
Ooh, yeah, Molly. We're committed to high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. It also helps a lot when you subscribe, rate, and review the show on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. And a reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all healthcare professionals at VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Special thanks to our writer, producers for this episode, Zai, and our whole Curbsiders team. Our technical production is done by the team at Podpaste. Elizabeth Prado does our social media. Jen Water runs the Patreon. Chris, the Chew Man Chew, moderates our Discord. And Stuart Brigham for composing our theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Ira Krasnovskaya.